Hi, Dave Emery here. This is For the Record program number 1351. Conversations with Monty. This is conversation number 25. This is being recorded on October 12th of the year 2024. Before we get into the program proper, I want to announce that the newest flash drive, which will now be 64 gigabytes because we've exhausted the 32 gigabytes, will be available presently. So if people want to secure that, and it will have more shows on it than just the ones to date, now is the time to do that. And I emphatically recommend that people do that. I don't think, frankly, that we're going to make it as a people or as a civilization. And if, I think it is the responsibility of listeners as sentient beings, and that will sound really corny or pretentious perhaps, but to preserve the record of what the hell happened to our civilization. When your children or grandchildren who are living in, you know, rusted out or burned out Chevy sport vans, are asking, you know, and fighting former Army Rangers for rat-killing turf. And they ask, well, you know, what happened, Dad, or what happened, Granddad, or what happened, Mom, or what happened, Grandma, to the world that you were telling me about? You can unpack information from that flash drive and help to educate them about what happened. In addition to my entire life's work, both audio and printed, and also the brilliant comments from our contributing editor, Tara Fackel. The flash drive also contains a mini library of old anti-fascist books on easy-to-download PDF files. And perhaps something that is proof positive of my worst critic's assessment of me, which is about nuts, is the fact that this is my entire life's work, and I get no money whatsoever from this, not one penny. And neither does Monty, okay? So there will be a link in the written description for these programs, For the Record 1351 and 1352, that will enable you to get that flash drive, and please get that. I get no money whatsoever from this. Now, once again, it is my pleasure and privilege to reintroduce to our audience my new co-host, Monty, who will be unpacking some more of his brilliant research. And we are turning to Asia. Monty has characterized my work correctly, in my opinion, as Eurocentric. And what he is in the process of doing and has been in the process of doing is expanding the focus of this work to Asia. When Barack Obama had his, quote, pivot to Asia, unquote, which was then amplified by Donald Trump and then Joe Biden, and now I think Donald Trump again. I don't think Kamala Harris is going to win. It really was recapitulating the Japanese role, the Japanese position in World War II, and the extent to which what we as Americans have been told about what took place in Asia, what took place at the very closing phases of World War II, what the quote nationalist Chinese were, what the Korean War was all about, what the Vietnam War was all about, all of these things basically are outcroppings of the fact that we picked up where the Japanese left off. And, Monty, before we get into more of your brilliant work, I'm going to read a section of the introduction to the old anti-fascist books, because this, I think, will really set some context for what you've been talking about.
Yes, sir.
Here we go. The part of that description, the introduction to old anti-fascist books, begins as follows. In the decades since the end of the Second World War, much has been written about that war and fascism, the driving force behind the aggression that precipitated the conflict. Unfortunately, Much of what has been said and written has failed to identify and analyze the causes, nature, and methodology of fascism, German National Socialism, or Nazism in particular. A deeper, more accurate analysis was presented in literature published before, during, and immediately after World War II. And then SpitfireList.com is pleased to present a number of books published during that period. Almost all are more than 50 years old. These works embody a more complete, profound analysis of the historical forces that dominated the events of that time and, more importantly, our own. Whereas much contemporary literature on the subject presents fascism and Nazism in particular as an aberration, the phenomenon was an outgrowth of major political forces and dynamics that dominate and control contemporary events and processes. Some of the books presented here illustrate the extent to which fascism, Nazism in particular, was an outgrowth of globalization and the construction of international monopolies or cartels. Key to understanding this phenomenon is analysis of the Webb-Parmelin Act, legislated near the end of the First World War. A loophole in the antitrust legislation of 1914, it effectively legalized the formation of cartels, international monopolies, for firms that were barred from domestic monopolistic practices. Decrying what was viewed as excessive and restricted, quote, regulation, unquote, here in the United States, U.S.-based transnational corporations invested their profits from the industrial boom of the 1920s abroad, primarily in Japan and Germany. This process might well be viewed as the real beginning of what is now known as globalization. And I list some of the programs that talk about this. And okay, it says, for the records, 99, 361, 426, 511, and 532 present an overview of the reinvestment of the wealth generated by the American industrial boom of the 1920s in German and Japanese strategic heavy industry. It was this capital that drove the engines of conquest that subdued both Europe and Asia during the conflict. We also note that the failure of American industrial and financial firms to invest their capital in U.S. infrastructure contributed significantly to the onset of the Great Depression, depriving American industry of the monies needed to sustain the engines of industry and commerce. And one of the things that we have been talking about is the fact Monty, could you hear my reading of that okay?
No, it appears your mic cut out for about 40 seconds.
Okay. Okay, well, in that case, let me reread some of that. Well, let's see. Some of the books presented here illustrate the extent to which fascism, Nazism in particular, was an outgrowth of globalization and the construction of international monopolies or cartels. Key to understanding the phenomenon is analysis of the Webb-Parmelin Act, legislated near the end of the First World War. A loophole in the antitrust legislation of 1914, it effectively legalized the formation of cartels or international monopolies for firms that were barred from domestic monopolistic practices. Decrying what they viewed as excessive and restricted, quote, regulation, unquote, here in the U.S., American-based transnational corporations invested their profits from the industrial boom of the 1920s abroad, primarily in Japan and Germany. This process might well be viewed as the real beginning of what is now known as globalization. And it was this capital that drove the engines of conquest that subdued both Europe and Asia during the conflict. We also note that the failure of American industrial and financial firms to invest their capital in U.S. infrastructure contributed significantly to the onset of the Great Depression, depriving American industry of the monies needed to sustain the engines of industry and commerce. And that is an introduction to what we have been talking about. And in our program last week, Marty, you presented some just brilliant and to an extent for me, eye-opening documentation of the continuity between Operation Sunrise, which I had previously understood as the genesis of the formal collaboration between the Third Reich and its intelligence cadres, composed of the SS and the OSS and fledgling CIA, but it also might be termed Operation Rising Sunrise because it also saw the genesis of the collaboration between U.S. intelligence, the U.S. military, the U.S. financial system, and the Japanese. And in that regard, there are links in our last two shows and also in For the Record 1345 and 1346 to For the Record programs 905 and 1141. Talking about not only the profound links between Japanese and American industry and finance, but also about the Japanese subjugation of Korea. And you were talking about Per Jacobsen, Jacobsen, a top official with both the World Bank and the International Monetary Fund, and also the Bank for International Settlements. And he, in turn, was working in connection with various Japanese officials, including a guy named Fujimura, who was the Japanese naval attaché to Bern, Switzerland, where Alan Dulles, a key partner in Sullivan and Cromwell, and in charge of secret intelligence in Europe during World War II, correct me if I've got his title wrong, was holding forth. And the various Japanese officials involved with what we might call again Operation Rising Sunrise, of course Japan being known as the land of the rising sun, were operating at the behest of a profoundly powerful figure, very important guy named Kodama Yoshio. His name in English was spelled Yoshio Kodama, but Asians put their first name, their last name first, so the proper address would be Kodama Yoshio. Am I recapping that properly, Marty?
Yes, with one small annotation, if I may.
Sure.
Before Kodama Yoshio took over these activities in 1946, out of what was the name of the prison he was arrested in? It was a Sugamo prison that Yoshio
Yes.
was in.
Yes, he
Yeah,
was, yes.
right before he takes over these activities out of Sugamo prison, I should note as a liaison officer to a United States Army colonel by the name of Jack Young Cannon, last name spelled Canon. The commander of these operations that was working with Per Jacobsen was actually a lieutenant general before Kodama would take over, and that was a lieutenant general who was actually chief of operations of the section of the general staff, meaning the Imperial Defense Policy officer that was in charge of the operational section of the Japanese general staff, specifically the element of the Japanese general staff that was in charge of the Ministry of Military Affairs Bureau for the Southern Forces. Okay. And the actual title for that is Deputy Chief of Staff of the Southern Army, which was a position that this officer took over in 1942. And that would be a general by the name of Akamoto Kadofuku. And the spelling on that name is OKAMOTOKIYOFUKU. And I should note that he committed suicide 15 August 1945. But at the time that General Akamoto was meeting with Per Jacobsen, he was in fact wearing three hats. He was the military affairs advisor, once again, as I pointed out, to the Southern armies. And a little clarification on what the Southern Army Command was in Japan. Everything south of Thailand and north of Australia was considered Southern Army Command for the Japanese. So that is the military intelligence command that General, or actually Lieutenant General Akamoto oversaw from 1943 onwards, okay? A massive military intelligence dragnet. But he also wore multiple hats.
And Monday, I just want to interrupt briefly. One of the challenges that you're going to face in these programs, I will be interrupting you
Sure.
periodically to make sure that you
Please.
present the documentation from which your information comes for the benefit of listeners who are taking notes, and also
Right.
the spellings and pronunciations of names. And this is not in any way to be considered a finding of fault, but rather the foundation of what I've been doing, and I'm in my 46th year on the air, is frankly pedantry, because so much of this is completely unfamiliar to listeners. Beyond that, much of it is the opposite of what they've been led to believe. And so in that regard, I think it is critically important for us to present the documentation from which that you're operating from, and also where necessary to present the spellings of names and pronunciation. So please bear with the frequent introductions. Now, this is all coming from the papers of the Interagency Working Group on Nazi War Crimes. Am I giving that name correctly?
That's correct. I'm still quoting from the previous resource that we had in the most previous broadcast, and that comes directly from the Interagency Working Group on Nazi War Crimes, from the Nazi War Crime Disclosure Act. And these ultimately are being archived out of the Office of the Historian, historical documents from Foreign Relations of the United States. In today's program, I'm going to be specifically quoting out of the diplomatic papers. Once again, this is from the Office of the Historian of the State Department. This is Foreign Relations, United States, Diplomatic Papers, 1945, The British Commonwealth, the Far East, Volume 6, Document 360. So that's what I'll be quoting from today when talking about Jacobson's activities, Peer Jacobson's activities with various representatives of military intelligence for the Japanese and a financial institution called Yokohama Specie Bank. Okay, so that's
Right.
what I'm quoting from today.
Very quickly, one of the things, the reason that I read that introduction to the old anti-fascist books is that the events and the processes and the institutions we are talking about here are at the very foundation of the post-World War II global economy. And Per Jacobson was one of the founding, one of the generating people for both, and he was from Switzerland, for both the World Bank and the International Monetary Fund. Both of those created at the Bretton Woods Conference, which I believe was in New Hampshire in November of 1944. And the Bank for International Settlements is one of those financial institutions that before the war and during World War II saw free financial operations between the ostensibly opposed warring powers. And even as the soldiers, sailors, and airmen for the Axis and for the Allies were slaughtering each other in World War II, the people who ultimately pulled their strings were moving around vast sums of money. And although a lot of this stuff may appear, arcane, weird, the things we're talking about, and again, the reason I read that introduction to old anti-fascist books, which are available on the flash drive, is because this is absolutely fundamental, with a capital A and a capital F, to the global economy. And we think of globalization as something that, is recent, right? Trump is talking about he's going to bring American corporations home. He's going to do all this. He knows as much about economics as he does about high energy physics. And, he's going to do whatever he's programmed to do. I personally think he's a mind control job, But that again begs the question of whether or not he has a mind to control. And I do think he will win the election. I think Kamala Harris is an empty pantsuit, and Trump is not only mentally incompetent, but it's not so much what Kamala Harris is, it's what she isn't. And what she isn't is a Nazi, and Donald Trump is. And but I think I think we're doomed. But it is so important, Monty, for people to understand the processes that you're helping to illustrate for us, because we don't understand what went on. And in that regard, if people want to understand, as I've said before, if young people wish to understand the world they live in, there are two events generally thought to be completely disparate that are inextricably linked. You have to understand the assassination of President Kennedy, and you have to understand the real history of World War II, which is very different than what we've been told. Those two things are inextricably linked. And a couple of books to read, all of the Seagraves books about Asia, the Song Dynasty, the Marcos Dynasty, the Imamoto Dynasty, and above all else, Gold Warriors, a book which apparently cost the Seagraves their lives. And also the book Martin Bormann, Nazi in Exile by the late heroic Paul Manning will give people a really fundamental understanding of what's going on. And to that, I would amend the brilliant and incisive work that Monty is unpacking for us now. So with that characteristically long-winded introduction slash addendum, Monty, if you could continue with Operation Rising Sunrise and the formation of the events in Asia that we have been told were the Cold War or the hot wars in Korea and Vietnam. And so much of what we have been told is essentially mythology. And we can document the fact that that is mythology. And it is the brilliant work you're presenting to us that is that documentation. So please continue.
Right. So ultimately, once again, I'll be quoting from the Office of the Historian. Once again, I'll read the title of the actual document. So this is a State Department, or reading again, Department of the State, Office of the Historian, Foreign Relations of the United States, Diplomatic Papers, 1945, The British Commonwealth, The Far East, Volume 6, Document 360. Okay. And this is a memorandum that was by the acting director of the Office of Strategic Services. And that's a man by the name of Charles Cheston, who was one of the executive directors of the OSS, to the Secretary of State. Okay. And this is dated Washington, July, 13 July, 1945. And I'll quote it in its entirety, if you don't mind, Dave.
Absolutely. Please continue.
Quote, "The following information received from Mr. Allen Dulles at Wiesbaden, dated 12 and 13 July, concerns a new Japanese attempt to approach Allied authorities through Office of Strategic Services representatives in Switzerland."
And that
Action
very
letter.
quickly, the spelling of that name, the office, you did just presented from the office of where now?
Wiesbaden. That's a W-I-E. Sbaden. It's the name of
Okay.
a city.
Wiesbaden, got it. Thank you.
Yeah, Wiesbaden. Okay, and reading again from the document. Quote, Per Jacobson, a Swedish national and economic advisor for the Bank of International Settlements, has been approached by Kojiro Kitamura. Spelling on that name is Kojiro. Last name, Kitamura, a director of the bank, representative of Yokohama Specie Bank, and a former financial attaché to Berlin. Kitamura indicated to Jacobson that he was anxious to establish immediate contact with American representatives and implied that the only condition on which Japan would insist with respect to surrender would be some consideration for the Japanese imperial family. Kitamura showed that he was completely familiar with OSS operations, which led to the surrender of German forces in North Italy, and declared that he wished to establish a contact similar to that made by General Carl Wolff. According to Jacobson, Katamura is acting in consent with the Japanese minister in Switzerland. Shinshiku Kase, who, as we pointed out in the previous program, Kase was the, effectively in 1945, the foreign minister in Switzerland that was serving under, foreign minister Togo, who in 1945 represented the cabinet of Hideki Tojo. And he was, Togo effectively served as Minister of Foreign Affairs and Minister of Greater East Asia. Okay. And by the end of World War II, he was involved in these illegal, surrender deals with Alan Dulles, yeah, which effectively, as we shall see, were not surrender deals in the sense that the Japanese were handing over everything. These were surrender deals in the sense, Dave, that certain concessions were made for the economic autonomy for the Japanese war cabinet in perpetuity at the end of the Second World War. So continue with this document. According to Jacobson,
this might even be better termed collaborative documents. But what really is happening here is a synthesis or a recapitulation of the relationships that have led to the American and Western financing of Japanese fascism in the first place. Go ahead.
Right. Absolutely. So according to Jacobson, Kitamura is acting in consent with Japanese minister to Switzerland, Shinshiku Kase, and is working with Brigadier General Kitamori Akamoto. The spelling on that within the document is K-I-Y-O-T-O-M-I. And last name spelling on that is O-K-A-M-O-T-O.
Please, Monty, continue. Whenever you read one of these Japanese names, if I can prevail on you to spell it, because most of the audience will not be familiar with this, and it's important to have that made clear. Please continue.
Right. So reading again on that, Japanese minister to Switzerland, Kase, is working with Brigadier General Akamoto, a former a Japanese military attaché in Bern. Akamoto, and this is a very fascinating portion of this document, Dave. Quote, Akamoto is probably the chief of Japanese intelligence for all of Nazi-occupied Europe.
So, and his name is spelled again, O-K-A?
Right. The spelling on his name is O-K-A-M-O-T-O.
Okay, and, Akamoto.
And this is the general, and for those that are listening to this program at a future date, it's fascinating that this document outright identifies him as the chief of all Japanese military intelligence operations for Nazi-occupied Europe, which I was unaware before I read this document, just on a personal note, that the Japanese military had a Gestapo-like dragnet, or perhaps some kind of a parasitic intelligence operation that worked through Nazi intelligence. But that's fascinating. So reading again, according to Jacobson, Kitamura is acting in consent with the Japanese minister to Switzerland, Minister Kase, and is working with Brigadier General Akamoto, a former Japanese military attaché in Bern. Akamoto is probably the chief of Japanese intelligence operations in Nazi-occupied Europe. Kitamura exclaims that the Japanese group in Switzerland has direct communications with Tokyo and is in a position to make definite commitments. Responsible OSS cutout sources who talked with Per Jacobson and Basil believe that Kitamura approach was initiated locally rather than on the basis of instructions from Tokyo. Ha ha! And that ha ha is a personal editorial, Dave. I will read that section of the document again. Quote, responsible OSS cutout sources who talked with Jacobson in Basel believe that Kitamura approach was initiated locally rather than on the basis of instructions from Tokyo. Hence, it is difficult to assess the seriousness of the approach. End quote. I'm going to continue to read from that document, but I wanted to read that twice for your listening audience so they can understand that this entire surrender deal with the chief of Japanese intelligence for all Nazi-occupied Europe was initiated by Alan Dulles, according to the assistant deputy director of OSS. I mean, this is an incredible document that Alan Dulles went directly out of his way using Carl Wolf's deputy in northern Italy, a man that we've previously identified as an SS major by the name of Guido Zimmer, last name spelling on his name is Zimmer, who was in fact from 1943 all the way to the end of the Second World War. Zimmer was the commander of all Einsatzgruppen operations in northern Italy and effectively oversaw the deportation of 2 million, potentially 2.5 million men, women, and children into the Nazi concentration camp system. So this
by the way,
is
the pronunciation of those groups would be the Einsatzgruppen, E-I-N-S-A-T-Z. Right. G-R-U-P-P-E-N, a big fan of these programs and a very sophisticated guy and someone who just raves about the interviews we're doing. But one critical suggestion he did make was to improve your German pronunciation. That's not a knock, but Einsatzgruppen, I'm not very good at myself. Einsatzgruppen is, they were the mobile killing squads that were used primarily on the Eastern Front in World War II, and what for our purposes is fundamental is they for all practical purposes were folded into the Galen organization at one level and ultimately went to work for Western Intelligence, CIA, NATO Intel in the post-war period. And this is from Guido, G-U-I-D-O, the U would be silent, Zimmer. Very important. So yes, very, very important connection here. And what we're seeing, again, is Operation Rising Sunrise. Continue, Bobby, please.
So effectively, this is the intelligence phalanx that existed between Nazi German intelligence in Italy and the chief of all Japanese intelligence operations within the European theater of command. And yes, according to this document, there was a massive Japanese intelligence presence in Europe based out of Bern, Switzerland. So during the Second World War. So this is the phalanx of intelligence officers that represent the deal that I'm about to present between Pierre Jacobson and Yokohama Species Bank, and an organization that was later dubbed by the CIA as BG Samurai, all one word. And ultimately, the BG bigram inside of the CIA's codename prefixes. BG represents Chinese intelligence, okay? So anytime any potential listeners that would go into these archives and look at these documents that I'm about to be referencing, anytime you see BG inside of the CIA's cryptonym system, that represents CIA operations that were penetrating Chinese intelligence. So real if I may, real quick, just to demonstrate the scope of the intelligence operations that we're looking at with this samurai organization. And I should note that that's not a jab at these people for being Japanese. That was, in fact, the CIA codename for this group of businessmen that Pierre Jacobson and Okamura would put in contact with Alan Dulles through Guido Zimmer. Okay, so this is a Chinese, this was an operation that was set from the very beginning in 1946 when this was put into effect to target the mainland Chinese communist operations. Okay. So in effect, yes, you are correct, Dave, when you say that this isn't just a continuity of Japanese intelligence operations under Alan Dulles and Bern in 1945. This is complete cooperation with Japanese intelligence operations. So
it is basically, Bobby, it is a synthesis of the forces synthesis that were to dominate the post-World War II global economic landscape. And when Obama talks about his, quote, pivot to Asia, unquote, really what we are seeing is a shift of forces and emphasis to the dynamics that are a continuity from Japan's activities in Asia during World War II. Basically, we have taken, like a relay race, we have taken the baton passed to us by the Japanese, but yet, via Golden Lily, they're with that golden and the jewel encrusted baton themselves.
Right, right. So, continuing with the documents out of the State Department, once again, this is from the historical documents, Foreign Relations of the United States, Diplomatic Papers, 1945, The British Commonwealth, Far East, Volume 6. Okay. And reading again, quote, the OSS representative in Bern reports that Per Jacobsen has urgently requested him to come to Basel to see him this coming weekend. The OSS representative has declined the invitation, but told Jacobsen that he could see him in Bern on 15th Sunday, July 1945. This OSS representative, I should note that they're referencing here, is Paul Blum, who was one of the deputy commanders of OSS secret intelligence operations in Switzerland. Continuing. The OSS representative in Bern will see Jacobsen only to obtain such intelligence as Jacobsen is able to give, and expects to treat the entire matter with the greatest caution and reserve. Continuing in a second memorandum, so this is a memorandum by the director of the Office of Strategic Services. This is a memorandum from William Donovan to the Secretary of State. Okay, and this is dated 16 July 1945, Washington. Quote, the following information, a sequel to a memorandum dated 13 July concerning a new Japanese attempt to approach Allied authorities through OSS representatives in Switzerland, has been received by Mr. Alan Dulles in Switzerland. But the information was supplied by the source in reference to memorandum Per Jacobsen, a Swedish national and economic advisor for the Bank of International Settlements in Basel. Jacobsen has asked to see Mr. Alan Dulles and was brought to Wiesbaden to the purpose of 15 July returning immediately to Basel. Jacobsen reports that between 10 and 13 July, he had a series of conferences with Yoshimura. The spelling on that name is Y-O-S-H-I-M-U-R-A. Yoshimura, a Japanese official attached to the Bank of International Settlements, and Kojur Katamura, last name spelling on that, K-I-T-A-M-U-R-A, a director of the Bank of International Settlements and the Japanese representative for Yokohama Species Bank and former financial attaché to Japanese intelligence operations in Berlin. Yoshimura and Katamura claim to be acting in consultation with the Japanese minister to Switzerland. That's Minister Kase, spelling on that is K-A-S-E, and Brigadier General Akamoto, former Japanese military attaché in Bern, who is now believed to be chief of all Japanese intelligence in Europe. Yoshimura and Katamura claim that Prime Minister, that Minister Kase and Okamoto, that's General Okamoto, have direct and secret means of communicating with the Japanese chief of staff. That's at the time that was Japanese chief of staff Yoshijiro Umusuke, and the last name the spelling on his name is Y O S H I J I R O, last name U M E Z U. Okay. Reading again. Yoshimura also claims that the peace group which he represents includes the following personnel. Japanese Army Chief of Staff, Yoshijiro Urumetsu, Admiral Mitsumasa Yonda, who is the Minister of the Navy. The spelling on that name is M-I-T-S-U-M-A-S-A, last name spelled Y-O-N-A-I, who was the Minister of the Navy in 1945, and Shigenori Togo. The pronunciation is Shigenori Togo, who was at the time The Japanese foreign minister to all of Europe. The spelling on that name is Shigenori. Last name spelled Togo. And as minister to foreign minister of Europe, I should note that foreign minister Togo, in liaison with Alan Dulles, was a personal conduit to Hideki Tojo. Okay. So Alan Dulles, through Foreign Minister Togo, had a direct communication liaison with Hideki Tojo in July of 1945. This communication liaison existed, okay?
And Hideki Tojo was in charge of, nominally in charge of the Japanese military in World War II. He actually was sort of scapegoated for, the Japanese war of aggression and then executed. Really, he was something, I mean, he certainly was guilty of war crimes, et cetera, et cetera. But I don't think it is altogether unfair to refer to Tojo as perhaps the Lee Harvey Oswald of World War II and Japanese fascism.
Well, I don't think that's a fair assessment, and I'm sorry to make this disagreement on the air, but according to the Seagraves book, Gold Warriors, it has to be appreciated that they identify Hideki Tojo in 1931, and this is in chapter 3 of the book. Unfortunately, I don't have the physical book in front of me, but I know what chapter it's from. It's from the third chapter of the book. Tojo is identified as a chief of intelligence for all occupying forces in Manchuria, and effectively was the commander of the Japanese version of the Gestapo. And what was the proper name for those intelligence agents?
The Kempei Tai.
The Kempei Tai. Yeah, Tojo was the commander in 1931 of the Kempei Tai and what eventually became a puppet state called Manchukuo. So we have to appreciate, Dave, that at least 15 million men, women, and children would be turned into slave laborers and occupied China effectively because of the intelligence operations of Hideki Tojo in 1931. So
well, thank you for that correction. I appreciate that. I'm going to have to go back and reread some of the Seagraves texts because I know at one point they kind of indicated, that, well, I guess maybe not the Lee Harvey Oswald, but he was sort of the sacrificial lamb. They clung him.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I will agree 100% with that assessment. Tojo was, yes, I will agree with that assessment. He was a fall guy for the Japanese occupied forces. Yes. Yes.
The
definitely.
Whole thing. And, you know, you referred to the Yokohama Specie Bank. That was 25% owned by the Japanese emperor. It was one of the major vehicles for the transfer abroad of the almost unimaginable wealth that was looted by Japan under Golden Louis. It was later renamed the Bank of Tokyo. One of the top officials with that was Yosuke Ono, Yoko Ono's father. And by the way, I've just completed an essay for the Patreon platform. What did Yoko Ono's father do in World War II? And in a sense, we're seeing what Yoko Ono's father did in World War II. And he was the Japanese naval paymaster in 1933 for a British trader named Frederick Rutland, R-U-T-L-A-N, Rutland of Jutland. And, he was training Japanese pilots to fly off of ships for the Mitsubishi Corporation in the early 20s and also helping to develop, various aircraft for the Japanese Imperial Naval, Air Arm, in the run up to World War II. And of course, on December 8th of 1941, it would have been December 7th in, here in the other side of the International Dateline, the aforementioned Kodama Yoshio, established the Kodama Fund to use the underworld looted, material, gold, you name it, contraband, from, China to fund the Imperial Japanese Naval Air Arm. And Yoko Ono's father was deeply involved with that concatenation. Now continue, Mavi, please.
So, thank you for pointing that out. Reading again, this is from the Foreign Relations of the United States Diplomatic Papers, 1945, British Commonwealth, Far East, Volume 6. And reading again from the document, Yoshimura and Getamur appeared to Jacobson no longer to question the principle of unconditional surrender, though at one point they asked whether or not unconditional military and naval surrender might not be sufficient. Now, that is a very important distinction right there, because that's effectively what happened, Dave, after the end of the Second World War for at least a solid 10 years, roughly to about 1955. There was no military service within Japan. Instead, there was an occupier force called Supreme Allied Command Pacific, or SCAP for short. S-C-A-P, Supreme Command Allied Pacific. And the commander of SCAP from 1946 to 1953 was a general by the name of Charles Andrew Willoughby. Okay? So
he's a person we've spoken about before. May Karl Adolf von Scheppel and Wiedenbach, a German-born intelligence official in charge of G2, or military intelligence, for Douglas MacArthur in World War II and the Korean War, and someone who admired not only Mussolini, but also Francisco Franco, the fascist dictator of Spain, into whose service he then transitioned in the early 1950s after his formal retirement from military intelligence, and an individual whose activities, the importance of whose activities could not be exaggerated. So please continue. Charles Willoughby, so important.
Right. And as an editorial note to Willoughby's post-World War II activities, it has to be appreciated that Willoughby effectively was the commander of all Central Intelligence Agency operations during the Korean War. He was the theater military intelligence commander and effectively oversaw the CIA station not only in Tokyo, but he also oversaw CIA operations in Okinawa, at Sugi Air Base, and in South Korea. He was effectively CIA commander of all operations during the Korean War. So really, once again, cannot downplay just how powerful these characters are that we're mentioning. So
yeah, Willoughby, again, it's a name you just don't hear, and yet he is so important with the capital S and the capital I. Continue, Bobby.
So, reading again from the document, Yashimura and Kitamura appeared to Jacobson to no longer question the principle of unconditional surrender, though at one point they asked whether unconditional military and naval surrender might not be sufficient. And once again, as history has proven, that concession actually did fall into play. The military and the Navy did surrender to Allied forces and effectively became something called the Self-Defense Force, and which is simply a front for a continuity of intelligence operations within the umbrella of the CIA during the Cold War. Continue with this document. On his own initiative, Jacobson replied that such a proposal would not be acceptable to the Allies, but would be considered merely a quibble. Both Japanese officials raised the question of maintaining Japanese territory integrity to include Manchukuo, Korea, and Formosa.
Formosa is the island. Formosa, I think, was the Portuguese name for that island. It is now called Taiwan. And it was the island to which Chiang Kai-shek and his narco-fascist Kuomintang retreated when the Chinese communists defeated them militarily on the mainland. And when we get into the Korean War and what that did, among the things that it did was to preclude any Chinese invasion of Taiwan. We're still hearing about that. It was up in World War III, but it effectively saw to it that the Seventh Fleet would be protecting Chiang Kai-shek on Formosa. And a quick note about Chiang Kai-shek, although, again, we hear all about, you know, democracy, blah, 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 Taiwan, blah, 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 blah.
Right, right.
The older I get and the more I come to understand international fascism, Asian fascism in particular, one could not exaggerate the importance of the narco-fascism of Chiang Kai-shek. He was not only a fascist, but he pioneered, in a way, the use of drugs as a vehicle of domestic subjugation and also conquest. And I didn't know till I read the Song Dynasty and also Go Warriors that heroin and morphine were marketed as very powerful tablets. And the reason why we get the powder in the West is that those morphine and heroin tablets are ground up in the powder and then cut repeatedly. And the reason why addicts in the West have to inject it intravenously is that it has become so weak, that's the only way they can get high. But the real pioneer of the use of narcotics, morphine and heroin, as a vehicle for not only subjugating a population, but for conquest was minted by Chiang Kai-shek. And then it was a fulcrum of his collaboration with the fascist Japanese. And I've been going on about it. It's really, really important. So, you know, today when people hear all about, you know, Taiwan is a self-governing democracy, first of all, the Chinese aren't stupid. And they're not going to invade Taiwan because they know bloody well what would happen if that happened. And most of Taiwan's trade is with mainland China. All they would have to do is effectively blockade it, which they could do. But history has not been properly presented to us. And one of the foundational elements in this magnificent tableau that you are filling in for us is a true understanding of what Chiang Kai-shek was and what the nationalist Chinese were. And again, for the record, programs 1195 to 1214 go into that, you know, based on the remarkable books by the Seagraves, primarily the Song Dynasty and Gold Warriors. So continue, Mappy, and forgive my periodic introductions. We're getting near the last 7 or 8 minutes of this interview. We'll continue apace in our next talk. So please do continue. Bear in mind, we're nearing the finish line for this program.
Absolutely. Before I continue with this document concerning for Pete's sake, I'm losing my space here. Concerning the two Japanese bankers that are working with Pierre Jacobson. Once again, I'll give you the names and their effective ranks. Of course, the two officials we're referring to are Yoshimura, who is a Japanese official attached to the Bank of International Settlements, and Katamura, who is director of the Bank of International Settlements and a personal representative for the imperial family's interests within Yokohama Specie Bank, and effectively a former financial attaché to Japanese intelligence operations in Berlin. So those are the two Japanese intelligence agents that are working with Pierre Jacobson as a representative of the Bank of International Settlements. And on that note, I'd like to pivot rather dramatically to what the interests were in Formosa for the Japanese. And I'd like to pivot to Gold Warriors by the Seagraves. This is can be found in the paperback version of the book, Chapter 3, titled The Rape of China. And if I may quote just three paragraphs out of this chapter, if I may, on page 35.
Please.
Little was done in Shanghai without the knowledge of Boss Tu, who took a bite of every pastry. Now, spelling on that is T-U, Tu. Businessmen who referred to payoff Tu risked being kidnapped or being shot or having their houses bombed. Once too abducted Mei Lei Sung, bride of Chiang Kai-shek, to remind the Generalissimo who was really in charge. By 1932, the 44-year-old Boss Tu had already had a great fortune. He was self-made man with a vengeance, born in desperate poverty across the river in Putong and a squalid sum called Kayoche. His father, a coolie in a grain shop. In his teens, Tu became a runner for the drug lord of the French concession, a chief detective known as Pockmark Huang. At the time, there were three gangs, the red, green, and the blue, competing for control of the drug trade. Boss Tu and Pockmark Huang, how they could have worked together, Excuse me, reading again. Boss 2 showed Pak Mar Kuang how they could work together as a cartel. Eventually, the red and blue gangs withered, leaving only Boss 2's green gang in charge of all rackets far up the Yangtze River into China's interior. By the 1930s, gambling was on the greater scale in Shanghai anywhere else on Earth, with proceeds more than $1 million every week. Boss 2's three-story Fengxin Casino on Avenue Fox provided customers with chauffeured limousines. There was dog racing at Two's Cantadrome. Over 100,000 prostitutes worked in brothels and cabarets and dance halls like Faran's and Del Monte's, where white Russian women danced and more with paying clients. Once they understood each other, Boss 2 became one of Chiang Kai-shek's chief financial backers. He shared drug profits directly with the Generalissimo and in return was licensed by the Kuomintang government in every brothel he controlled. This allowed Chiang to pretend that he was pursuing an aggressive campaign of opium suppression. But only Two's rivals were suppressed. The Opium Suppression Bureau turned over confiscated opium to the Green Gang for conversion into heroin and morphine. The Generalissimo received his cut through the Farmers Bank of China, owned by Two, and referred to sarcastically as the Opium Farmers Bank. Chiang Kai-shek used his cut to upgrade his military, which annoyed Tokyo. But during the initial Japanese assault on Shanghai in 1932, Boss 2 sent the Green Gang to fight the invaders. Chiang praised him for his gallant display of patriotism, but it was only a turf war. 2 not only prepared to let the Japanese undermine the control of gambling, prostitution, and narcotics, but General Dohihara, a spelling on that is Dohihara, worked out a compromise by which the Green Gang, the Kuomintang regime, the Japanese secretly divided the spoils as much as the blue and the red and the green gangs had done earlier.
I'm going to stop you right there because we're almost out of time. What I'm going to ask you to do in our next interview is to begin reading that chapter again. Again, I really appreciate it that you are unpacking that one for us. It is so important. But I want to stress that the 64 gigabyte flash drive containing all of my life's work, a mini library of old anti-fascist books, all of the interviews we've done with Monty, the conversations with Monty, all of my work on the development of the coronavirus, which was no accident. It did come from a laboratory. The laboratory wasn't in China, and it didn't bleep and leak. All of that is available on a 64 gigabyte flash drive. There will be a link. There is a link in previous shows to enable you to get that. And once again, I get no money whatsoever from this. And if some of this appears to be weird, long ago, far away, This,
no way.
If you want to know, people want to know why the hell things don't work right. This is why they don't work right. They haven't been working right for a long time. And what Monty is doing in characteristically brilliant fashion is showing us he's like an anti-fascist, intellectual auto mechanic. And you're getting up under the hood and fixing the carburetor and tuning the spark plugs and fixing the transmission and
yes,
showing
sir.
Us exactly why our car doesn't run right. And boy, it does not run right at all. So I'm gonna wrap things up at this point. This concludes For the Record program number 1351, Conversations with Monty. This is conversation number 25, and this is being recorded on October 12th of the year 2024. For Monty, this is Dave Emery saying thanks for listening.